Welcome to the Title League Podcast. I'm Kurt.
And I'm Trish.
Today we've got Bernie Lee, Jimmy Butler's agent, joining us. Very exciting.
It is exciting. Bernie has such a great story. An agent to one of the most interesting and talented players in the league, and especially in this last finals run. So,
yeah, one of the most polarizing figures in,
a really good word.
In the NBA, in the sports world.
Good word. Yes.
Very excited to have him join and talk a little bit about his client, how he got into this space, and what we can expect with free agency whenever that actually begins.
We were listening to one of our competitive podcasts today that were talking about what the next NBA season is going to look like and where our Raptors are potentially or possibly going and what it's going to be a very different type of a season. But January 18th, is that the consensus?
Tentatively.
So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Bernie has to say and what that's going to look like. And honestly, you know, what's next for Jimmy and the journey that he's been on. But I'm super curious to find about how Bernie got to this place. He did not come from a typical background that would end up as an NBA agent. So I'm super excited to hear his story and find out how he overcame his struggles to get to where he is today.
I think about some of the articles I've read about him, and was obviously a basketball junkie, loved it, worked at different camps, worked his way into the basketball world, but never thought he could actually have a career out of it. So, I'm always interested to get the perspective of, you go from, you know, being around the game that you love to now representing a superstar in Jimmy Butler. What is it like being thrusted into that environment? All of a sudden, there's these players, when I say players, industry players that you're now competing with and surrounded by, the CAAs of the world, the Clutch Sports of the world, Rock Nation. It is very interesting to see how someone who is independently represented like him, and how he, you know, holds his own in that room, and what was that dynamic like, and getting used to the limelight of having a player like Jimmy.
Exactly. It'll be great to have him on.
For all our listeners out there listening, please make sure you go follow us on Spotify, listen on Apple, subscribe. Trish, where else are we?
We're on YouTube. So if you'd rather watch your podcast and listen to them, then give us a follow and a subscribe on there.
Wherever you find your podcasts, if you want to watch them, you want to listen to them, as Trish said, make sure you give us some love, share it, follow it, give us a rating, and, you know, spread the word. People find podcasts through word of mouth. If you really enjoy it, tell a friend.
And like we say numerous times, if you have anything specific that you want to hear on us talk about, or any guests that you'd like us to try and land, just DM us. We are fans just like you, and so we want to know what you want to hear.
We want to start adding that mailbag, so drop it in the DMs and you'll be featured in one of our interviews.
And now welcome Bernie Lee.
Welcome to the Title League Podcast, Bernie Lee from Cortex Basketball. Bernie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you being patient with me so I could find the time to sit down with you guys. But thank you so much for having me.
We appreciate it. And it's a funny story how we connected. You know, I went to IMG Academy in the States, a prestigious training facility for some of the best athletes. And one of my coaches had actually worked with Jimmy Butler. So that is how I got connected to you. But it's kind of funny because a friend of ours who watches and listens to the podcast, he lives in Toronto, and I had noticed that he had put an article on his story that referenced you, and it was a story in the Toronto Star. And I said, you know, I think I know the Toronto space pretty well. I never knew this story, and I found it so amazing when I read about your story. So all of a sudden, I said to him, well, do you know him? He's like, no. And then I realized, oh yeah, Jimmy Butler, IMG, he's worked out with my old coach. So, you know, I asked my coach, I said, do you know Jimmy Butler's agent? He's like, I don't know him personally, but I have his number. And I just remember giving you a call, and you were extremely, you know, welcoming. And I know we went back and forth. It was a busy time, but very, very happy to have you on today. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I'm new to the basketball community. So it doesn't stop surprising me how tightly knit, but how small it actually is too. So there's only like a few degrees of separation to find individuals, whether you're in personnel or in management or players even. But I'd like you to start off by kind of telling us a little bit about your story, Bernie, because for those that haven't heard it, where you came from and how you got to be in the basketball agent space.
Yeah, no, you know, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I think I'm one of those kind of stories where for me personally, like I look back on it, and as I was going through it at the time, I obviously had an altruistic view. I didn't see any other way for it not to work. Like basketball has kind of always been like a foundational kind of part of my life. And now sometimes like that I have the gift of hindsight and I look back on it, I see it kind of for what it is, maybe the way some other people see it. And it's been, you know, knock on wood, hopefully it's a ride that's continuing, but it's been a pretty amazing ride. So, you know, I'm 42. I was born in Toronto, grew up in Toronto, in North York. Just kind of started playing basketball when I was around like the seventh or eighth grade. And it just became like that, like, you know, defining part of my life. You know what I mean? It was the way that I connected with the world, connected with the community around me. And just, I think like a lot of Canadians now, things have kind of like evolved in terms of like our basketball community. It wasn't maybe like the most natural things to do when I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. Like we didn't have an NBA team, but we have that like little small, like kind of click, just people that just fall in love, like with the NBA. And you know, I definitely was kind of one of those people. So I played basketball through high school. I always had it in my head that I wanted to be a person that when I was done high school, got the opportunity to go, I wanted to go to school in the U.S., you know, play college basketball in the U.S. and experience that. I did that my first year out of high school. I went to a school in Chico, California. It was funny, like I went there like totally sight unseen. Like I had no other real options of going into any other place. I was like kind of like considering like two other schools, like basically the only other two schools that had called me my last year of high school. And combined, they went, I think it was 2-50.
Oh, wow.
So obviously both those coaches got fired, which probably tells you like my level of ability. If like the two schools that lost 50 games combined were the only two schools recruiting me. So at the end of my last year of high school, I didn't really know what I was going to do. I got the opportunity to go to school in the U.S. It took me like 10 minutes into like my first practice of being at school there to realize like as much as I love basketball, I wanted to be my future, I would have to find a different like path than in terms of playing. So I did that for a year, came back, went to school in Waterloo. I went to Wilfrid Laurier, played basketball there. And I knew like I wanted to try and figure out some way to stay connected to the game. Like I thought I was going to be coaching. And so every summer I would work basketball camps, things like that, just kind of like staying in the bubble of it. Around the time that I graduated, I kind of decided like, I didn't know if coaching was going to be, you know, my path at the time in Canada. Really, like the only way to earn a living coaching basketball would be essentially like working Raptors. Like we didn't have like a ton of opportunities, and I decided like I probably didn't want to live on my parents' couch for like the rest of my adult life, or maybe they didn't want me to. I probably would have been happy with it. Fortuitously, like I got introduced to an agent, started working with him as an intern, and was like one of those people where I'm so lucky in the sense like within the first 7 days of doing it, I realized it was what I was supposed to do with my whole life. You know what I mean? And like I think now I'm kind of at that age where a lot of people like I'm friends with and grew up with, we're all kind of hitting that point where you've hit that part of your career where you have that moment where you sit back and you're looking like, huh, is this me? Like, am I doing the thing that I was supposed to be doing? And I'm like, you know, I can definitely say I'm one of the lucky people that like, I kind of get quiet when those conversations come up because like, otherwise I'm just kind of bragging, right? Like I got really, really lucky and you know, I have the best job on the planet for the time being.
And you didn't come from a really economically stable upbringing either. So that's one of the things that I love highlighting on this show, particularly when we talk to players, because a lot of the players don't have this charmed life. There's a lot of struggle that goes on, a lot of struggles within families, and that they're able to use their talent to overcome and then have these successful lives. It's really great for our listeners to see that you don't need to be a player in the NBA in order to overcome the challenges that you grow up with. And you're a shiny example of somebody who's been able to take that passion and rise up and still be able to live your dream, even if it isn't as a player on the court. I don't know how, if you want to get into that at all, but how did your struggles motivate you, or did you find them to be a motivator, or was it easy to just fall back and say, I can't do this, why am I trying?
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. Like, the thing that I would tell you that it's been the gift of, like, my job, it's been this point to be exposed to, like, so much, right? So many people, so many different places, all these things. The one thing that I've learned, one of the major things I've learned over time of kind of having my career, everywhere I go, everybody has a story. You know what I mean? It's blown my mind, the amount of kind of like similarities. Like, I'll meet people in China, people in France, and, you know, we all have, like, you can pick out kind of who's from where, you know what I mean? And what the backgrounds are and what the struggles of families are and all these things. And it's like, as much as we are all unique people, to a large extent, a lot of our stories, in terms of kind of where you fall in that spectrum or arc, there's not a lot unique in it. Like, everybody has a story, right? And for me, I was one of those people that I had two parents that maybe didn't have the gifts of being able to, like, make that path really, really smooth for me. But the one thing they always empowered me for was just, like, that blind faith and belief, you know, and that blind faith and belief that we live in a world and at a time that the things that you want, if you work to them to the best of your capabilities, you have the opportunities to kind of get them. So, like, my mom was, like, the type of mom that would be like, yeah, no, why can't you do that? You know what I mean? Like, duh, you know, like, and you think back on it, and now I have it, and I'm becoming the more conservative parent, you know what I mean? And I catch myself and I'm like, oh, that's probably not right, right? But, like, I'll give you guys an example. In Toronto, they came up with an educational policy. It was called streaming. And when you were somewhere around the 9th or 10th grade, what they were trying to do is, like, I think what the aim of it was trying to make the classrooms better in a sense for the higher achieving students to get, like, shitheads like me out of the way of these people at the time, right? Like, I was a person, I liked school, but I don't know that I necessarily took, I was 15 years old, right? Yeah. And so in Ontario, you have to, if you want to go to university, at my time, it was, you have to go to high school for 5 years and you had to be taking advanced level courses to be able to qualify for that fifth year to go to university, right? So when I was in the 9th grade, maybe like in November, December of that year, my teacher calls home to my mom and says, hey, it might be time for us to sit down and, you know, have a talk about Bernie's, like, progress, right? So I'm automatically, like, stomach hurt, like, ooh, I'm going to get in trouble now, right? Come to the school and the teacher tells my mom, it was my 9th grade math teacher. Teacher tells my mom that she thinks that it would be best for me not to be in the advanced level. I should be in the general level and it might be more guided to me and what my capabilities were. And my mom, I just remember my mom's face. She looked at this woman and she said, well, if he does that, he can't go to university, right? And the teacher was like, yeah, you know, maybe university isn't necessarily for everybody, blah, blah, blah. And I could literally see, like, steam coming out of my mom's ears, right? Like, and I sat back like, oh, I'm not the one in trouble anymore. Like, right? Like, and yeah, my mom let this woman have it, like literally have it. I think to this day now, so that would have been a solid 17 years ago. So when that article you guys are talking about coming out from the Toronto Star, I'm pretty sure my mom was like, the person that found it and sought out this woman that was my 9th grade teacher just to make sure, like,
that she saw it. She didn't just get the link. She got the physical paper, the cutout mailed to her.
That's a Jay-Z line.
You know, I'm not going to lie. Like, she had a point. Like, I sucked at, like, calculus and algebra. And I wasn't applying myself, but the thing I've become really good at this point has been, like, you know, your basic accounting and exponential math. Like, I can nail that. Right. Yeah. But to her credit, you know, I was a jerk.
Wow. So, you know, Bernie, you fast forward to getting into this space and, you know, you said it earlier, you're a Canadian working in an American industry. And, you know, one of the most important pro leagues in the world, one of the only real North American leagues that's global. And you're representing one of the most polarizing athletes in the game. He is incredible. We love to watch him. We just all cheered for him during these finals. What was it like initially before all of this when you got into the space and you're in the room and there's the CAAs, there's the Clutch, there's Roc Nation, these big, big brands, these powerhouses, and here you are representing yourself as an independent. What was it like early on and how did you say, wow, you know, I belong? Like, I'm going to make my name. I'm going to really, really carve out a space for me in this league.
Yeah, you know, I think I've always tried to lock into the substance of it. You know, the thing that I've learned about my clients and all players across the entire league is, like, you know, you take any NBA player, no matter the level that they hit, they have an astute ability to really read people. You know, like they become conditioned from probably at a really young age because, you know, basketball players are so early identified. And there's an aspect about them too, because the majority of people we're talking about are, you know, for the most part, exceedingly tall. They get treated like adults at such a young age, and they have to grow this ability to really kind of sift through who the people that are trying to become part of their lives and what their intentions are and all these things, right? So for the most part, like everybody like I've dealt with within the course of the NBA, like, they don't care about the stuff that you're mentioning, like with the back office and like the bells and whistles and frills and all that kind of stuff, right? It might get you a meeting, but the thing that's going to actually have you have a sustainable, you know, career with somebody is like who you actually are. Like the people that hire me, they're hiring me. You know what I mean? They're not hiring my resume, they're not background or whatever. It's like, what's the thing you're gonna do with me over the course of the next day, week, month, because this is my only opportunity. Like, I'm happy that you've been able to do those other things before, but this is me, this is my life. Like, what are those things you're gonna do? So for me, like, I've kind of locked into that aspect and that aspect of like responsibility and like accountability, you know, and I wanna be the person in terms of doing what I do, that on a day-to-day basis, like, I'm gonna live up to the things that I say, I'm gonna hold up my end of the bargain, and just lock into what's the next thing? What's the next thing that we're supposed to do? And you continually kind of pile those up in a positive way. You end up at some point, you're able to have a bunch of those successes, and you look back and it feels like, you know, a career or some element of success, but I've never kind of locked into the minutiae. I've been so kind of locked into the process, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and you grew up playing the sport. You love the sport. You were a player first, right? So naturally, you know, you're a fan of the game. So you now find yourself and you've got, you know, Jimmy Butler, you've got, you know, Aaron Holiday, you've started to put together this portfolio and now you're around different people. You think of Miami, legends like Pat Riley, Coach Spo. Do you ever just look around and be like, you know, wow, you know, where I was as a 13, 14-year-old playing, wishing that I could play in the U.S. and then ending up at Wilfrid Laurier. And now I'm in and around the most desired league in the world.
Yeah, no, it's awesome from the perspective. Like, sometimes I'll take a step back and see it from that perspective of the 16-year-old me, you know, the 17-year-old me, you know what I mean? That just wanted to go to an NBA game. Like, I saw my first NBA game at the Dome. And it was a preseason game between the Bulls and the Pistons. And I was able to go there because I went to National Sports and bought a pair of shoes and they gave you two free tickets. Like, that's how I saw my first NBA game. And now, you know, I have the opportunity to like have a relationship with somebody like, you know, Pat Riley or like Michael Jordan, the person that and, you know, those aspects are pretty cool. But the thing that I've learned, and this is what's kind of normalized it, strip away all that stuff, it's human beings, you know what I mean? And it's human beings that have worked in a way to where they've gotten some opportunities, made the most of those opportunities, but it doesn't actually change. Like, people you're talking about, like, conversations that we'll have will be about like our families, you know, will be about like day to day, like, and it's been really interesting for me to kind of see the humanity behind the industry that I work in. You know, one of the most awesome things about the NBA is it's a league with a family base. You know, we're people that have been around each other for a really long time. For the most part, like, we're pulling for each other when we have successes. We know each other's families or kids, wives, like all these things. And, you know, we're just this very like kind of close knit group. And for the most part, for the last number of years, like, it's been a league with a lot of success and we've all been able to share in it. So, you know, it's a really fortunate and lucky time, you know. And at the end of the day, like, I think we're a bubble in generation now. Like, we're people that grew up like just loving and admiring the NBA, and now we get to work in it. So, and
that's
we
what's
have these
pushing it forward. Yeah.
You're all a big family. So when do you get the two other holidays?
Right now, actually, I have. Yeah, I work with Justin Holiday. Wow. And Aaron, his younger brother, and they're like one of the coolest basketball families like I've met. You know what I mean? Like, their sister also played at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And from what I can pull together, from what they told me, might be the toughest one out of all the four kids. Like, that's the sister that. Their parents are really high level athletes. Justin's dad, I believe, is like in his 50s, still like can get out on the floor and like work out with them, dunk. Like, it's just one of those Wow. cool stories. You know what I mean? Like, just awesome. Those are the things I get to see with my job. It's amazing.
It's crazy to think like three boys that you raised that are all playing in the NBA, and their sister, so the daughter who played at a high level. It is remarkable to think of this, the talent, right? And I've never seen Justin or Aaron, but I've been around Drew, and I couldn't believe, I mean, just the talent is remarkable.
I tell people all the time, I think Drew might be one of the most underrated players in the NBA. He's the best perimeter defender in the NBA, and like, it's so slept on. Like, he didn't make one of the two all defensive teams.
I know, right?
Be the best perimeter defender in the entire freaking league. Like, it's crazy to me.
It is crazy. And just retracting a little bit, because I totally forgot about this. You said Michael Jordan, and then it just clicked. Obviously, Jimmy Butler signed to Jordan. That is, you know, tell us an experience or a Michael Jordan story, maybe your first interaction. You know, what has that been like?
You know, the first time I actually met Michael Jordan was totally independent of anything, you know, Jimmy related. It was like, I worked as a counselor at Five Star Basketball Camp when I was in college. And Mike Jordan, I think he'd been retired for maybe like 2 years at this point. And he came one day to lecture the campers, right? And it was like a huge lesson for me in terms of like the mind of like an elite player, and in terms of the way they're able to kind of translate that stuff and kind of like the ability of like coaching. So Michael Jordan, greatest all-time one-on-one offensive player. Like, don't argue with me. Like, it is, right? If you ever saw him play, you get
it. We're not arguing. we know who the GOAT is in this room.
An age separator for people that will debate whether or not Michael Jordan was the best ever, right? If you're over the age of, like, 35, you get it. If you're under, you're going to be in line of argument.
Right, but in the defense of those who are under 35 after The Last Dance, I don't think very many of them are arguing anymore.
You just can't. And like, we'll circle back to this, but the other layer to that argument I always make is Kobe Bryant is number two.
Absolutely.
Like, damn right.
Yeah.
You can't argue the other part, right? But so for Michael Jordan, he comes and he's the counselor, greatest one-on-one all-time offensive player, and he's supposed to talk about one-on-one moves facing the basket, right? So they give him a ball, he has a microphone, he's standing, there's 300 campers sitting there, and he's like in abstract, like trying to talk about these things, right? For the first like 5-6 minutes of the speech, first of all, we're all sitting there looking like, oh my god, it's Michael Jordan, like, oh my god, he's gained like 25 pounds, right? So like, you're like sifting through like all this stuff. And then after about like 7 minutes, you realize like, man, he has no idea like how to verbalize this stuff. You know, like he couldn't explain it or coach it. He gets frustrated, right? He goes, you know what? I don't want to do it like this. He goes, he looks at one of the other coaches from camp. He's like, I want you to give me the 20 best players in the camp and just line them all up, like line them up. So they grab the 20 best. They put them in a line. Michael Jordan plays every single one of them one-on-one,
whoa,
right? One after another. And it takes him a little bit to kind of get into it, but by like third or fourth kid, like he's Michael Jordan again, right? And without him like explaining it with his words, he was doing it with his actions. He just taught you how to play one-on-one basketball. So he would stand there and have the ball and be like, okay, see this person's lead foot and the way his balance is? He's like, I'm going to do this. And then he would do it. And you'd be like, oh my God, right? Like, he started getting to a point, like these are kids too, right? These are kids that were between the age of you know, 15 and 17. One of them made the mistake of wearing Duke shorts that day. Like, this is a kid, right? Like, his parents probably bought him these shorts. Like, he didn't know any better. Michael Jordan sees this kid in Duke shorts, and he's standing there holding the ball, and as he's pump faking at him, he goes, nice shorts. And it was like, hey, man, like, my grandmother bought me these, maybe? Like, who knows, right? Like, I didn't choose to offend you with these. And he kills the kid. Like, and it was
hot take. Michael Jordan's mean to kids.
Oh, yeah, and I took that personally. Isn't that so? It was the example for me, like moving forward, of like the value of, and you see this a lot. You see it a lot with, like, typically the ex players that are really good coaches or the guys that were like journeymen or like that middle of the road guy that had to really understand how to navigate the entire business to have success as a player, as opposed to that high level guy that was just like really, really good. They can't explain how they do what they do. They just do it. And they sometimes get frustrated at the other people that just can't do the things that they do. You know what I mean? It's like, well, why don't you just do it? Be like, because I can't. Like, I'm sorry, I'm trying, you know? And it's kind of interesting.
Well, and I mean, just think how frustrating that is for him as an owner, because it's not his place to coach. It's not his place to run the team.
Right. He slapped one of his players in the back of the head on a bench. Like, he's done this. Like, it's amazing, right? And if it's Michael Jordan that does that to you, you just got to take it as a player and be like, yeah. I'm sorry. Like, I'm not you, like.
I'm garbage, man. I'm sorry.
I tried, you know. I got to a point where I became one of the 450 best in the world, not the best.
That's right. And we talk about that a lot.
I want to talk about Jimmy, because Kurt used the word polarizing. It's a perfect word, but the more I kind of get to know Jimmy Butler, the more I think this is just a guy who knows himself. And knows what he wants. And if it was any other industry, we would reward people who went after what they're worth. Like, we teach kids to value what they're worth and to stand up for what their worth is. And everything I see about Jimmy is that. And he may be polarizing, but it endears me to him. It makes me want to root for him. And when we were watching him in the playoffs, I was cheering for him. I was like, this is your mom taking that article and sending it to your teacher in grade 9. This is, I told you that I can do this, and here I am able to do it given the atmosphere that I'm in.
Yeah, you know, I've heard the term like polarizing with him be used sometimes, and I don't know if I'm being naive. Like, sometimes I think about it and I think, like, I don't know what's polarizing about it, but I think he's driven people to a position to where, like, there's no like gray area on him, you know what I mean? Because there's no gray area about himself. And like, the thing that I've learned over the course of time is like, in terms of working with him and watching his experience is, I think confidence and brutal honesty sometimes make people uncomfortable, you know, in like the broader sense. And if you notice, like, he's not a guy that is boastful about himself in any sense, you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't often talk about himself in any way, right? But I think some of the things that he said, as it gets like twisted or construed in a way where it feels like what he is talking about himself, but really what he's talking about is process to a large extent. You know what I mean? And the things that he's kind of saying that I think people kind of glam onto, it's like, either you are or you aren't. You know what I mean? It's like, there's either you are working really, really hard, or you are really driven by these things, or you aren't. And if you aren't, over the course of time, it's going to kind of like show itself, right? And we want to give people the benefit of the doubt and give people time and things like that. And I'm a patient person, and I'm with it. One thing that's really clear with him is he's not, you know, he's going to call the truth out for kind of what it is. And then I think it's put him in some instances in these, you know, confrontational or conflicted kind of positions. And that's where, you know, you begin to form opinions and things like that. But it was really interesting for me. And I always knew it, but it's more interesting for me now that everybody kind of knows it. The experience of the finals and the playoff run, it kind of validates, you know, validates this old school kind of process. To me, I always kind of knew it was there. You know what I mean? And I've been able to see it on a incremental scale, and I see it up close every day. Now it's just such like a, you know, an undeniable thing that he did it on the biggest stage. Now everybody knows it, and it's just kind of indisputable. And, you know, now it'd be interesting to see where he takes it kind of from here. You know what I mean? And I don't know if, like, I don't think he's going to care, but I've been wondering, like, is it going to be an adjustment for him now to be the person that everybody pulls for? You know what I mean? Because yeah. before, like, he was really motivated, not necessarily really motivated, but I'll give you an example. I remember the first game he played in Minnesota after his training camp stuff, it was against Cleveland, it was a home game, came back, decided to play, right? And those people in that group of fans, rightly or wrongly, whatever, it's their position of fans to be entitled to, they very clearly were not with his position, which meant that they weren't necessarily with him, right? And it was like a game for him that I saw him really be excited to play. So we go to the game, and it was me, his brother, and two other people. Purposely, like, he put us in four seats that were, like, courtside and midcourt. And the entire time in the beginning of the warm-up for the game, like, he's talking to us. He's like, this is going to be fun. Like, the whole crowd is like, remember, like, first time Vince came back to Toronto or Steve Francis.
Oh, yeah.
Goes to
Uber.
Like, it was like that, right? So I remember the first the first basket he scored in that game, it was on the first possession. And as he ran back on defense, the whole crowd is booing. They've been booing him the entire kind of warm-up. I could hear him, his voice over the voice of 18,000 people, booing himself after he scored. He was going to the crowd. And I'm thinking to myself, like, good Lord, right? Like,
who is he?
By the end of that quarter, he played so, I think he had the first, like, 14 points of the game, and he played in such, like, an inspired way. That same crowd, as he was shooting free throws at the end of the first quarter of game one, started chanting MVP.
And I know, right?
I realized, like, that's the beauty of the drive. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not necessarily driven towards success. It's driven towards that need not to fail. You know what I mean? And there's a beauty in that fire as well.
You said confidence, and that is definitely it. You think about the start of this season. Obviously, it was a long year, long season, but no one ever expected Miami to go to the finals. But the confidence that he instills in his teammates, and that's all he's ever wanted. And you look at the guys like Tyler, Duncan, Bam. It's David versus Goliath against the Lakers. You've got experience and vets and big guys. And he was able to instill confidence into these young guys that they believed in themselves. You know, you said he's not going to go around and talk about how great he is, but he's always talking about how great his teammates are. And that is the ultimate, the ultimate success in what he's been able to do in Miami. And we all saw that, and we weren't even there, right? As fans, we saw that. So it's been amazing to watch.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to me from the perspective of, like, his ability to kind of create his own reality, you know, like, in terms of the expectation of everybody else, they probably didn't expect that. But I can tell you, like, without kind of, like, blowing smoke at this point, he kind of always expected it. Like, none of it necessarily surprised him, which is kind of amazing to say aloud, but it's a God's honest truth. And that empowerment thing that I would, that you've picked up on in terms of the teammates and everything like that, I would tell you, like, it's reflected as in his entire life. You know, it's, like, reflected in me. You know, I'm a person that, as an agent, like, I built, like, a decent career up to that point, but I hadn't worked with somebody that was, like, you know, top 5 to 10 player in the league. For whatever reason, he saw a value and connection in me. And he gave me an opportunity, and really, like, the way his brain works, I can see now, as we've been kind of down the road, it was to empower me and help me to get to a higher level than maybe I've been at before. And this is just, like, in our business life and our personal life. And I watch him on a day-to-day basis, like, do that with his teammates. Like, he'll pick a teammate every year that you wouldn't necessarily think of on paper and decide, like, he's going to change that person's life. And I've watched him do it 4 straight years now. You know what I mean? Like, it's 5 straight, 6 straight. Like, it's kind of amazing, you know? And he, I've noticed that he has that connection with fans, and the fans that really spend the time to, like, pay attention and lock in. It's that strong connection, because I feel that majority of people feel a connection or admire the athletes that they're watching, they look at it from the perspective of thinking to themselves, what would I be like if I was in that position, right? And Jimmy, for the most part, I've noticed is one of those people that you can look at and be like, yeah, no, I would be like that. You know, I would be a person that I'd like to believe I've worked pretty hard. I'd be a person that is mindful of these things or does these kind things for where these stories are quirkies, or even like some of the other moments where he's just reflecting frustration. Be like, yeah, no, that comes from the heart. Like, I get that. You know what I mean? And that's where like I've sensed where that strong bond comes from. It used to be that it was a smaller kind of segment, either with him or not with him. But now that he's kind of had the success that he has, it seems like it's a broader base. So we'll see where that goes.
He's very selfless. And I was watching a video not so long ago on YouTube about his free agency decision to go to Miami. And seeing him at the table with the people around him and making sure that he said, it's not just my decision. It's my team's decision. Like, who says, you know, I'm going to relocate my trainers or the people around me because they have a family and I want them to be happy. That just blows my mind.
Yeah, no, I you know, without like giving away too many of his secrets, like I watch it on a day-to-day basis. And I watch him do, like, there's a lot of things that we see that filter out to the public just because he's kind of hit a stage where, like, he's kind of newsworthy and notable. So when he does something like dribble a ball in a hotel room and security gets called, like, everybody hears about it. But I would tell you, like, for the every, like, one thing that you guys see, I see 10 things on a weekly basis that, like, if really it saw the light of day would be, you know, and it's inspiring in a bunch of ways.
Bernie, you know, we spoke a lot about Jimmy. You have other clients and we, you know, afar, we're watching this space. We watch the NBA. There's talent, a lot of talent coming up everywhere. You know, I obviously want to shine a light on Canada, but for the young guys that are coming up and obviously you want to continue and you want to recruit and you have young guys that join and you're going to represent them. How do you keep that balance of you've got a guy on a huge contract and you have a guy that's just trying to get onto a roster?
Yeah, no, I would tell you that the experience is unique to kind of each person, right? And like for me, I'm appreciative of the varied experiences across the way. Like, do I like that I was a person for the beginning portion of my career that really experienced things from a different end, and now I'm at this other point where, for the most part, like I just get yeses. Yeah, no, it's awesome, right? But is that reality? No. And the beauty in my work is seeing whoever the person is to scale get the most of the opportunity that they've had and feel like they've achieved a goal and being able to ride that kind of journey with them. So now I would tell you, like, at this point, you know, I've done what I've done for like 16 years with like a bunch of different people from a bunch of different perspectives. And I have the experience to kind of, you know, help them to kind of navigate what that path looks like. And I'm really excited for the next kind of, you know, portion of my career to kind of take those experiences and help like the next person to do it and you know, kind of build on those things. And look, like, it again, everything is the scale. Like, you don't have to go and have your success be measured on the same path as you know, somebody else. Like, your success is your success, you know. Like, anybody that plays basketball and gets to the NBA, you played one game in the NBA, like, you've accomplished insurmountable odds. Like, guys that are on two-way contracts, like, you don't know, you can't even imagine the things that they've had to navigate to kind of get to those spots. So for me, it's just like trying to help really, really talented people at a kind of volatile portion of their life, because they are very, very young, just be the best themselves and capitalize on an opportunity and kind of live out their dreams. And then at the same time, be able to pull as much fulfillment out of that opportunity while they're in it, that just allows them to kind of, you know, lock in and have a really good experience and get the most out of it.
We, I speak to a lot of young guys that are coming out of high school or in college, and I always forget how young they are, because a guy who's 18, 19, how does he pick the right agent? How does his family know where to go? And the NBA is not very forgiving. There's 450 spots. You said it. Making it there is one thing. Staying is another. And the guys that are in the G, the guys that are on two ways, you know, one one week you're staying at the Ritz-Carlton, the next week you're playing in a community center. It is so, a lot of people don't understand that side. And a lot of times representation is so important. And I feel bad for some of these kids because they don't know, and families don't know that there is resources, but are those resources available to select the right representation?
Yeah, you know, for the most part, like I tell people a lot, it's following intuition, you know, like when you get to a certain level, and I've learned it from like a Canadian standpoint, right? So we look at things from a standpoint of being like very conservative. And when we hit a certain level and you start having like a higher level of success, there's a part of us that inherently thinks that one, we were like somehow really lucky to have this happen. And two, it could disappear at any time. So it makes you make like these short-sighted decisions when the reality is like, one, you probably deserve it. Two, you can work to make the beginning part of your opportunity a larger opportunity, right? And that's the way like we have to think about it. From like an American standpoint, I've learned with a bunch of people that I work with, they always expected that. You know, and it's that like that mind shift that allows kind of, you know, more long term decisions to be made in a better way. So I would tell like especially Canadian families, a lot of the younger ones is one, like follow your intuition. You know what right and wrong is. You know when someone's blowing smoke up your butt, you know when they aren't, right? And you don't have to make a decision. No one's going to be able to make this easier for you. It is going to be hard no matter who your child is, no matter how good it is. There is an element of work. There is no such thing where I can make it a for sure thing that what you want to have happen happens. Because truly what it's going to come down to is tapping into the human part of your child that happens to be really, really good at something. So we strip away all the other nonsense and let that talent kind of come out. So what's the part of that that's going to be able to connect with? And that's a hard thing, right? So there's no amount of success that I've had in the past. There's no amount of money that I'll pour into this that's going to make any easier. None of that stuff. It's like, as a human, how am I going to help you to connect? How do we make everything else easy, shut off all the noise, and then we let your talent come out? Because we've all identified you have this talent, right? So how do we let that be the best that it's supposed to be every single day? That's really what it comes down to.
It seems pretty basic, but there's a lot of people who don't put that time and energy to realize that that's what your focus should be. And we have another show that interviews the moms of NBA players, and yeah. It's been quite eye-opening to see that there's a lot of really ill-intentioned people out there who really, you know, are only out for themselves and not out for the young, impressionable, talented person that they have in front of them. And then when the money's there and the talent's there, they're there. And as soon as it's gone, they're gone too. So it's
It's not for me to speak about the process of like anybody else or anything like that, but it's unique to me in that like we work in an industry in that, you know, obviously there's a high level of compensation and things like that. And there's an accessibility to the talent pool, like kind of when it's younger, right? But to me, like the most important thing to kind of lock into is the understanding that you're dealing with people's like opportunity, you know what I mean? And the humanity behind like all these things. They're not like, they're not like this abstract thing that you're watching on TV or for you to benefit from. Your own benefit in terms of my role, like it's not part of this equation. You know what I mean? Like if you do the thing that you're supposed to do and you do it well, then you're going to benefit from it. But you're not doing it solely for that benefit. You're doing it because you want to focus on doing something well, right? That's what we should all do. You should want to be, you know, the best podcaster that you can be. I should be worried about, you know, and it's just like if you look at it in that kind of sense, it becomes kind of simplistic, you know, but a lot of times maybe sometimes that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it is the way it is, and honesty is a key portion to it too. You know, 450 spots in the NBA, but there's a lot of opportunity for a professional basketball player that isn't the NBA, and it takes an agent and it takes a team to really research and be honest with their players and push them in the right direction, as opposed to setting this one goal that may or may not happen, or you have a client that may or may not reach it, and then they're left destitute because there's no other options that have been placed in front of them except that one unattainable one. So anyway, I mean, you guys aren't unique. This is life. We have good people and we have bad people. We have people who take advantage and those who don't. And it just is what it is. But it's coming from somebody who's only ever been a basketball fan and has never, like I said earlier, been in a basketball space for yeah. work. I'm one of those people who thinks every NBA player is making millions of dollars, and if they've made it onto a team, they have a set charmed life. And yeah. you know, not to be all, oh, poor NBA players, but there are people who get taken advantage of too, or who make wrong choices. So,
yeah, you know, I say it a lot in terms of like what I do is, and you know, the money aspect of it's an inescapable reality, but the God's honest truth is like, compensation doesn't remove a person's humanity, because either I have a contract or I get a certain amount of money. It doesn't stop me from being human. It doesn't stop me from having the same kind of ups and downs as like any human being, you know? And when I was really young in my career, I had the opportunity, to have like this really cool conversation that stuck with me. Like every day I think about it in some way, shape or form. So there was this player, you remember the AM1 mixtape tour?
That's right. Yeah.
It was him in I think it was Foot Locker.
Yeah. Well aware.
Yeah. So there was this guy in it. His name was Alamo. And it was his playing name. He's a 6'7" like point guard. He was from like Queens. His actual name was Tyrone Evans. And I remember somebody introduced me to him, and he was having a lot of success, you know, building a name, being an AM1 like street baller or whatever. And he was trying to cross over and play like mainstream basketball. So somebody put me in touch with him, and I remember having a conversation with him. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to play in the development league. He wanted to see, like, am I good enough for this? We'll kind of see where this goes, right? At this point, he was like maybe 26 or 27 years old. And I remember saying to him, why do you want to do this? You know what I mean? Like, you could just do the AM1 thing, and, you know, you've built a really solid name for yourself. And, you know, this seems like it's going really well. Why would you extend yourself to try and do this thing? And he said to me, he was like, you know, I realize like I have a God-given talent and ability. And he was like, I just want to see how far it goes and see how good I actually am. And he was like, I can live with whatever the outcome is, but I can't live with the fact that I'm not going to try and take this as far as I can go. And if I'm not good enough, then I'm not good enough. If I am good enough, great, you know, but I'm not going to waste the time and the talent that I've been given. And when he said it to me, it was like such a profound thing. And I was like, man, like that's actually a really cool way of looking at it. And for me, it's become a foundational thing in the way that I've looked at my entire career. But for him, I remember like 3 weeks after that, I sent him to a G League open tryout, and he wasn't good enough to play that kind of basketball, right? And the coach came back and was like, he's an awesome guy. I just don't think he could play in this league in the way that we would want him to play. And I remember I had a conversation with him. He accepted it, you know, he moved forward. He maybe didn't necessarily agree. I don't know if it was his best day or whatever it was, but he accepted with giving the effort and ending up where he ended up. And then like, I think it was maybe 3 years later, he died. He died at like the age of 30, 31. He had I believe he had like a kidney or like liver issue or something like that. But I remember like seeing the press release when he died and thinking of that conversation. And here's a person that essentially at that point when we had it had, you know, another 36, 48 months to live. He didn't know it at the time, but what he's expressing is like, I'm not going to waste any time. Maybe he did know. I don't know. Right. But it's been one of those things where, again, and it's to scale. So whether it's like somebody that goes to the NBA finals or somebody that's just getting to the NBA or a two-way guy, like I'm so respectful and mindful of kind of that thought of this is my opportunity. I want to see how far it can go. I don't want to waste any time. I'm not going to leave anything on the table. Like it's an amazing way to go about life.
Time is not guaranteed, so you got to make the most of it. I have just some questions that I kind of some rapid fire stuff. So you had two clients in the bubble, right?
Yeah.
You know, you think of some relationships between client and agent or player and agent, however you want to look at it. I think of a relationship with Kobe and Rob Pelinka, you know, guys yeah. are very close. And, you know, were there days, Jimmy was there for over 100 days. Were there days you got calls and you're the resource of like, man, you know, it's hard in here. I just want to, or I had a bad game. Like, what do you think?
No, from a human standpoint, you know, a majority of my conversations with Jimmy don't have anything to do with basketball. Like he can handle the basketball part. You know what I mean? Like he doesn't, much as maybe I would like to tell him how I think we should do something. Like, it's beyond my comprehension. So I just like appreciate it, you know. But yeah, no, definitely from a life standpoint, like you look at the entire NBA that experienced the bubble, right? And I would say to every person, whether it was an equipment guy, whether it's an assistant coach, a player, they all made a sacrifice in a way that kept our business going. You know what I mean? Like if the NBA had have stopped on March the 11th and didn't come back, I can honestly tell you, like, I don't know what the future of the business model moving forward, we'd have some tough times ahead of us. And they all did something. Like I did it for, I think it was like 13 days. I don't know how they did it. Like, I don't know how they did it for like 90 something days, you know, and it wasn't something that I thought was going to be as kind of seamless as, and it's a testament to like everybody that kind of, you know, did do it. So from that perspective, it was like super interesting. But like, you know, from my perspective, like I remember I go to the bubble, start going to the games. We sit up above, you wear masks, like you stay away from everybody. It was a change in like kind of what our routine is, right? So like I have go to, you know, all the major games that I need to support my clients, like stand in the tunnel, do these things. Like it was like kind of really removed. But I remember I did this thing at the end. I don't think I'll get in trouble for revealing it. But so when they lose game six in the finals, where I was, we were supposed to leave out one door. They had the media leave at another one, and they had the players leave at like the back area, right? So in my career, like I've become the person, like I figured out like the gaps in like NBA security, if that makes sense, in arenas. So I can, I'm like that kid that can sneak into an arena because I can tell you like, this is where they're going to deliver the supplies. So if you just act like you're carrying like a watermelon, like in Dirty Dancing, they'll just let you blow right by, right? I carried a watermelon. Like that's But I'm like a.
I can't believe that you just referenced Dirty Dancing.
Like, my little daughter, that's where I got it. But yeah, I will carry the watermelon. So the game ends. It was like this amazing series that I'm watching from 100 feet away and watching this person that I've worked with every day for years, like do, but I haven't actually been able to have that interaction. So when they lose, like in my head, I'm like, I'm not just going to leave and like, you know, I got to go tell them, like, man, that was awesome. So start like figuring out this building. Now, what I started learning about the security was like, it was really, really tight for a reason, right? They had zero cases, zero issues because they were pretty diligent about it until like I showed up. So I started like just walking around this building, right? And figuring out how am I going to get back to where the buses are for the players, just so I could stand by the bus. So when he walks out, I would be able to have a 30-second conversation. And I remember I got through like three or four checkpoints. I really don't know how, right? And I got to the fourth one to where I could see the bus, right? But I had the one guy that was the employee of the month and he saw through my nonsense,
the
right?
The keener that wouldn't let you through.
The watermelon over my head, right? So I had this like name tag on. And I don't know what it was. Like, it was flipped around. I purposely flipped it around because I didn't want people to see that I had a different color than I was what I was supposed to be, right? Now, keeping in mind, I wasn't risking anybody. I'd been testing every day. I wasn't trying to put my nonsense and, you know, risk everybody else's health. So we'll put that caveat to the side. And I respect what they had to do and everything. So you know, now I've said that. So something happened where like the guy was like gonna like literally strangle me. And he says to me, like, turn your name tag around. Like who let me see your thing. And when I turned around, I don't know what it was. Like somehow he saw my name and he was like, oh, I know you. And I was like, huh? Like, he's like, no, just come with me. Somehow he knew like I was connected to Jimmy or whatever it was. And he let me through. Right. And he put me like in front of the bus. And I remember I had to pretend like I was furniture, right? So everybody else kind of like moved around me and I just waited. And then I remember when Jimmy came out of the back, he went to walk right on the bus and he kind of stopped. I hadn't seen him at that point in almost like 4 months. And he kind of looks at me, he's like, what the hell are you doing here? Right? And we were able to talk for like, you know, maybe 20, 25 seconds, but it was that moment of like, just like, I didn't really know what to say. And this person I talk to every day, but just to be like, man, I have so much respect for what you just did. You know what I mean? Like you worked like really, really hard. I'm really happy for you. Like you deserve it. You know, like this is not, This is not like somebody gamed the system to get what you just did. Like, you worked every second of every day for years and years and years, and hopefully you build on it from here. But it was kind of like, and then he climbs on the bus and I look around and I'm in like this enclosed, like, I don't even know at this point how the hell to get out, right? Like, I had to go back and find my guy again, be like, it's me, like, you want to walk me out? Like, yeah, it somehow worked out. I probably got 100 people in trouble, and to all those people, I'm really sorry, but yeah, thank you.
And what did he say to you in that moment?
He just kind of looked at me like, what the hell's wrong? I could have seen you tomorrow, right? Like, it was a profound moment for me, but for him, he probably just wanted to go home and like get off his feet, you know what I mean? Like, so, but I felt like I did my part, I guess.
Well, Bernie, we have a few questions that I ask just to end every show. They're fun. God, you've already given me so many great references throughout the... We try to be more than a basketball podcast. We're not just a basketball podcast. So all the pop culture references, either the local ones or the international ones, are very much appreciated. You played right into the whole vibe of the show. So thank you for that.
I know you interviewed Jack Armstrong before.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've been in Halifax, and I hope I'm not adding anybody. He would love Liquordome as well, right? He would love Godfather. Jack's, I'm telling Jack next time I see him.
Jack's been to Halifax. Facts, but he's been for like the posh golf tournaments, the Danny Gallivan golf tournament that's at Ashburn Golf Club. And I don't know if anybody's ever taken him to the Liquor Dome. Maybe offline we'll figure out, but I did not get the vibe that he had anything more than the good cigar and the nice scotch on the golf course.
Yeah, he lied to you.
You get us the hot take from Jack Armstrong for the next. We'll get you back on the show. All right, so three questions. Don't think too hard. They're not basketball. They're Bernie Lee related. So if you were to write your autobiography today, what would you call it?
Thankful.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah.
Who would play you in the movie?
Oh, obviously Brad Pitt.
No, 100%. 100%.
It'd probably be Jackie Chan, but yeah.
I was thinking more Keanu Reeves. You give off a good Keanu Reeves vibe. So
much.
And if in what TV show, past or present, is most like your life right now?
That's Seinfeld.
Oh my God, Bernie Lee. I've been waiting for somebody to give me the Seinfeld answer. I've been waiting all this time. You're it, man. Number one guest. All you NBA players, I appreciated you coming on the show. We've had so much fun. Bernie Lee, number one guest. Good job. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, I don't think, yeah, we've had a lot of great guests, but this was a lot of fun. I mean, totally worth the wait.
No, thank you. And I appreciate you being patient with me. And, you know, I wish you guys the best as you build this out. And like, just from like a Canadian standpoint, like, I know what it is to be a Canadian, be really passionate about like our culture and league and the people in it and everything. Like, and we're coming from the same place. So I look forward to dealing with you guys in the future. Wish you all the best. And thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
A lot of fun.
Thanks for tuning in. Join Trish and I every week as we welcome the stars and personnel from the league we love, the NBA. Listen and subscribe for free wherever you find your podcasts.